Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Health Wealth Podcast. We've got a great episode this week. I've been really looking forward to this. It's been in the works for a while. We've finally got Dr. Nick with me here today. It's going to be an awesome conversation. So, Nick, first off, welcome to the show and how are you today?
I'm well, Ryan. I do appreciate you for the invite. I've definitely been wanting to speak to you for a while also. That's a beauty of a network, and I want to definitely wanted to touch base and get on your program. It sounds like, I've only listened to one podcast episode, but from what I've heard of your podcast, it very much resonates with me. So it's, a conversation I wanted to have.
That is awesome. That's awesome. So obviously I introduced you as Dr. Nick. You are an actual practicing doctor. So give us a little bit of background on yourself before we dig into some topics.
Absolutely. Yeah. So my name is Dr. Nick. My full name is Dr. Nboise. That's why I think my first year of med school, I learned my lesson really quickly. Don't tell people your last name because then they're going to struggle to pronounce it, and then they're going to ask you how to pronounce it. And instead of talking to them about their clinical diagnosis and how you're going to help them, now you have to explain how to pronounce your name for 5 minutes. I'm like, that's a waste. It's a waste of time. So yeah, I just tell people to call me Dr. Nick. I am a medical doctor. I primary care physician. I graduated med school in 2015. I graduated from the Ohio. Oh, actually, I'm wearing the shirt.
Oh,
The
there
Ohio State
we go.
College of Medicine. But prior to med school, I actually was an engineer. Well, I graduated from the College of Engineering, Michigan State University. So, specifically mechanical engineering. I loved everything about engineering so much so, Ryan, that I would argue that engineering and engineering principles and kind of first principles thinking and breaking everything down to its most fundamental elements still very much that is a mindset and an ideology that still very much follows me throughout life. So yeah, that's a little bit about me. I've been, like I said, practicing medicine basically since I started med school. So, 2011 and love what I do. I definitely have some very different thoughts as it pertains to the healthcare system, especially here in the United States. And I have very different thoughts as it pertains to, how we can all seek optimal health. And that's something I'm sure we'll get into, but yeah, that's a little bit of a background on me.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, we'll definitely get into that. Absolutely. What was it that obviously you said you qualified in engineering first. What was it that made you then decide to go into medicine?
That's a great question. That was actually always the plan. In high school, I was fortunate enough, had good grades enough to qualify for a scholarship. It was a full ride scholarship. They would pay, everything of my undergrad. The primary stipulation, however, was that if they were to pay for everything, it had to be engineering. So, the only choice they gave me, they were like, hey, like we will pay for everything, but it has to be engineering. But at least you can choose what type of engineering. So obviously I had to pick between, civil and between civil, mechanical, electrical, all the other choices, within the engineering realm. And I chose mechanical. So thankfully, even though that was the stipulation that was given to me, and obviously shrouded in a huge offer of paying off my undergrad responsibilities, I also knew when I accepted the opportunity, I knew in the back of my mind that you could apply to medical school. You could be an art history major and apply to medical school, right? It's more so about having the foundational knowledge, which you do need to take some courses. Even as an engineer, I needed to take certain pre-med courses. I needed to take the MCAT. I needed to have good enough grades in engineering that they would even consider the possibility of letting me into med school. So that's exactly why, Ryan, in engineering, I definitely busted my butt. I realized in the back of my mind for those 4 years that, me being accepted or denied into medical school was fundamentally predicated upon my performance in engineering. Even though it was a wholly and entirely unrelated field, I knew that I had to perform. So just kind of put my head down for the 4 years, focused, and graduated with a very high GPA, such that many medical schools decided to offer me an interview. And the one that I chose after all the interviews was Ohio State. So
awesome. And I suppose, like you said before, a lot of the principles of engineering probably kind of transfer across to medicine and to many areas of life. So I suppose it's not overall too dissimilar.
Absolutely.
A question for you then, as we like to talk a lot about nutrition on this stuff, and you know, we talk about the medical industry as well. How much nutrition training did you actually get when you were trained medically?
That's a great question. I think what I'm about to say is pretty well known, in a lot of spheres, my own included, that unfortunately medical doctors do not get a lot of training into nutrition. I would even go further than that, Ryan. I would say not only do we not get a training into nutrition, we do not get training into movement, not even necessarily exercise. I'm talking about the fundamental movements, right? Think about, as a human being, you need to be able to sit. You need to be able even beyond where this is technically not a squatted position. To me, this is just a seated position, but you need to be able to sit. You need to be able to squat. You need to be able to stand up when you are lying recumbent, when you're lying either supine on the ground or prone. You need to be able to get yourself up off the ground. You need to be able to get objects from above you. I think that there are fundamental movements that are inherent to the human experience that we are not necessarily trained in. And I'm sure some people could argue, well, that's not, within a medical doctor's purview. That's not our responsibility. And I don't contend that. I wouldn't necessarily assert that, but I would assert that regardless, irrespective of whether or not that's within a medical doctor's purview, that is part of your patient's health. That is part of your patient's, their ability to live life in a way that they would like to live in a healthy and sustainable manner. So yeah, we don't have nutrition training. We don't have movement training. So I have a personal training certification, actually two of them, a CFMDL1 and a CFMDL2. So obviously that's something that I had to take upon myself to learn. Everything that I've learned about nutrition, I've learned it after med school, after residency. I had to just put in the time and take the necessary courses. And I would say the unfair advantage that medical school gives you, specifically as it pertains to nutrition, though, is in understanding two things: human bioenergetics and biochemistry. So essentially what I mean by that is, when we eat the food, okay, what happens inside? What happens in every cell of your body that your different tissues of your body are able to generate energy from that food that you ate, and do so in a sustainable manner for the rest of your life? So I would absolutely argue that for the doctors who do take it upon themselves to learn nutrition, they have an unfair advantage in being able to understand this to a deeper level than somebody who would just take a nutrition class and, they don't know the first thing about the Krebs cycle or anything about biochemistry. And then it's funny, this point that I'm making to you now, I realize nobody has ever asked me this specific question, and I've never answered in this specific way. But thinking further on your question, I would also contend that even my background before med school, engineering, right? Then the engineering has given me a unique insight into movements, period, such that I think my personal training certifications have been further reinforced and solidified and strengthened by my mechanical engineering background. And it explains me even further, right? So anybody who has followed my account on social media for a while, they know that I am very capable of lifting heavy weights, not just with a squat or a deadlift, but literally across the board. I don't think there's a strength-based movement, bench press, squat, deadlift, snatch, clean and jerk, overhead press, across the board, I am strong. And I think that that's something that if somebody is astute and kind of perceptive, they're going to ask why. They're going to be like, that doesn't make sense. And why I say that doesn't make sense is because usually when I have noticed somebody in the gym who is very strong, they have one movement that they're very dominant in, right? They're very dominant in deadlifting. They're the guy at the gym who can bench, he can out bench press everybody. But you very rarely find one person who is much better than average on every movement. And I just reflecting on this question that you've asked me, and also knowing my history, I know that I wasn't born like that. I know that as a teenager, I wasn't like this, right? As a teenager, I was a nerd, right? I was trying to do what I had to do to get into med school. So it's not like I literally played no sport in high school. The only thing I did in high school was Taekwondo. I trained, got my black belt, and it was part of our high school curriculum to pick up Taekwondo if you wanted to, and I chose that. So it's not like I have this, you know, supremely foundational athletic background through high school, and oh, that's why I'm good at, you know, these movements across the board. I think what it gave me the unfair advantage, just like bioenergetics and biochemistry give you an unfair advantage into understanding the nuances of nutrition, mechanical engineering and understanding force vectors and, you know, and mechanical efficiency and all the nuances with just force, you know, throughout the reality of the human experience, I would contend that that gave me an unfair advantage with the weight room, right? And being able to lift in a correct manner, such that not only am I developing the strength that I need to, but I'm developing the correct musculature throughout my body. So I've literally never thought about this before, but that's a great question on your part.
Yeah, well, I'm glad we've got something from you there that hasn't been said before. Yeah, that's, I mean, I see, I follow your accounts. I see you're big into fitness. And I see you doing all of that stuff. And yeah, you're right. It's being able to do all those movements is important. I think you spoke before about movement. I think movement's a huge part of health that people forget. I think you get a lot of, you know, what we say, gym bros, maybe, that to them, movement is just going to the gym and smashing out whatever they're doing. Whereas, you know, movement's a part of life, isn't it? And being able to do everything. Yes. Someone, like you said, someone could go to the gym, they could bench a really heavy weight, but then in the rest of their life, they can hardly move.
Yeah, they can't run. You ask them to run 5 miles on a whim, and that person who can bench super heavy weight, they can't run 5 miles on a whim, right? They have huge deficits in other places. But no, I agree with you. I think movement is so foundational to life, and people like you and I at our age, Ryan, I think that we take it for granted. And you want to know the one thing that will quickly make you stop taking it for granted? Go to obviously as a doctor, I have experience with this, but even with that, you don't need to be a doctor to go to a nursing home.
Yeah.
And see at a nursing home the tremendous negative impact that a lack of mobility has on the elderly population. I mean, it makes you, at least from what I've observed as their doctors, it makes them feel less than human. It makes them feel less capable. It makes them feel disempowered and disenfranchised. And that's not something I wish on them. That's not something I would wish on anybody. But, you know, this isn't just about wishes. This is about determining the correct actions to take to ensure that that is not a reality for you. And I think one of the fundamental actions that we can take to prevent that, or at the very least, if not prevent, at least delay it, one of the fundamental actions we can take is at our current age, we need to do the work on a consistent basis so as to build that hedge, so as to build that barrier against disease and against sickness and against frailty all across the board.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's really important. As we age, and like you said, even on a much smaller level, I'm sure that you've had it, you know, yourself, when you have an injury and you can't do the things you normally can, even then you feel like, you know, you're getting frustrated. Yes. You don't feel you're worth as much. Yeah. So yeah, you can see it. And you know, I think people nowadays, with the our poor diet and the environment and our health, people are starting to get that old feeling, can't move, whatever, younger, I feel. I don't know. I mean, you said you've been practicing since 2011. In that time, have you seen people starting to get things younger and younger and younger?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this isn't even just a unique experience on my part. You can hear, you know, physician after physician say that we are seeing diseases younger and younger in the population. Not even just diseases, but I mean, what you're referring to isn't necessarily disease. You're referring to dysfunction, just a primary dysfunction. And yeah, I mean, you know, pediatric obesity, where we're getting to the point where one, at least here in the United States, I don't know about there in the UK, right? Mm-hmm. But here in the US, we're getting to the point where one in every two teenagers is obese by objective measurement, right? And that's terrifying. We're getting to the place here in the US where 88% of people, 9 out of 10 people, if you're in a crowd, 9 out of 10 people have some degree of insulin resistance, either, you know, pre-diabetes, type 2 diabetes, et cetera. You know, it's flagrant. I think the correct word to use is that it is literally a flagrant problem here in the US, and it's terrifying because, you know, I think that it's in reality a multifactorial issue. I don't think, I know that some people want to say, okay, it's only because of this problem. I think it is quite literally a hodgepodge, a multifactorial issue that, you know, it's a little bit terrifying when you think about, you know, where are we going to be in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, especially with the way we are as human beings. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you look, you know, before the time of the elevator, people would climb stairs, right? People would put in the work of the stairs. Before the time of cars, sure, people would ride horses. Yeah, you could argue that. But I would contend that even though people would have other means of transportation, that we would ambulate much more on our own two feet. These days, you have people who they want to go to Chick-fil-A or Burger King, and it's two blocks away. And instead of walking there, they're going to be like, no, let me get in my car and drive to Chick-fil-A to overindulge in, you know, hyper caloric foods that are extremely dense, energy dense. And, you know, I'm not even going to spend the energy to walk there. It's ridiculous. So I don't know where we're going as a society, but I'm sure, Ryan, that you feel the same way I do, in that you cannot control other people's actions. I can't control other people's behaviors. I can't control other people's actions. I know with 100% fact, I can control my actions, my habits. I also know, not 100% fact, but, you know, with a reasonable degree of certainty, that when somebody is my patient or somebody is my client or somebody is in my community, I know that all of a sudden I have an unfair amount or an unfair degree of impact and an unfair degree of influence on them. So hopefully explain to them, hey, you know, these are the things that I would recommend that you change in your life, right? But I think outside of those two groups of people, myself and then people in my immediate sphere, like, listen, I know for sure with the way the world is going and what I see as it pertains to epidemiology of disease just how it's, I mean, this, things are not moving in the right direction. But I do think that if you know, as somebody who strongly believes in personal responsibility, I do believe that that doesn't mean that any one of us are doomed to this scenario. We are all capable of change, but I think it all foundationally begins with education.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's our whole goal, is the education, just trying to get the knowledge out to people. Yeah, I think as humans, we're kind of hardwired to try and take the easiest way out, like the path of least resistance, I think. And some people argue that that's been actually the inspiration for some of the greatest inventions we've made, is trying to make life easier. Sure. But it is a negative, as you say. And like, I don't know, I'm sure you've seen, have you seen the film Wall-E and the Disney Pixar film, and the humans?
No.
Okay.
No. Right. I know exactly where you're referring to. Okay. But yeah. I think Disney is a whole bunch of propaganda, so I refuse to watch Disney movies, but yes, I know where you're, it's the guy, the bigger guy, he's laying down. It's like there's an image. I know where you're talking about.
Yeah. So that, but basically in the future, and humans have gone up to space, and they're so fat, they don't even move. They ride around in these spaceships and they've forgotten how to walk and everything. And you know, that's essentially where we're heading.
Yeah. It's absolutely wild. And listen, I think what you said is 100,000% correct. All of the inventions that we've had, right, have all been towards the betterment of mankind. However, I think that in as much as that may be the case, it is absolutely incumbent upon every single one of us to realize and to think, okay, well, interesting. You know, our brains are outpacing our bodies as it pertains to inventions and new creations. But in as much as that may be the case, does that mean that your genetics are changing? Does that mean that you're, you know, even though now we have cars and you're not walking as much and you're driving, oh, so did your metabolism just magically speed up in that interim of time that cars proliferated throughout the world? No. The elements of your metabolism, right? The elements of your health have all but stayed the same because genetics change very, very, very slowly. It takes so much time, generations upon generations. So given the fact that genetics change so slowly, we need to all be aware that, sure, we all have the glory of an elevator. We all have parking spot. You go to the store, parking spots are super close to the store. But if you're the type of person who, you know, you thought about these things that we're talking about, you're going to go to the store and you're going to park as far away as possible because you know now you're going to need to walk an extra long distance. You're going to come to a building with an elevator and you're going to say, no, it's going to take me more time, but I'm going to climb that 10 flights of steps just with my legs, no elevator, right? You're going to want to go to a local store and you can drive there and you're going to say, nope, I'm just going to walk there. So I think there's many, many different things that we can do to push back on the convenience of everyday life. It's almost like an over convenience. And there are many things we can do to push back on it. And I think that we will know if what we're doing is working if you do not follow the status quo, right? So you just mentioned Wall-E. If you do not look anything like a character from Wall-E, especially here in the United States, you are an anomaly. I am an anomaly. Like in med school, Ryan, we had so at Ohio State, there was a class of at least 350 people. I was, even back then, right, I was pretty much the only person who definitely the only person who did CrossFit, right? The only person who was as physically active as I was at that time. And even these days, when I see other physicians, other doctors who are my age, I am 40. So when I see other doctors who are my age, none of them physically look like me. So I think in my mind, it's actually a good omen. It's a good sign when you can look out into the world and see that in as much as, you know, we have this society where everything's crumbling, you seem to be the person pushing back against the trend, and you're not necessarily following. This is not a trend you want to follow. You do not want to be normal. You do not want to be, you know, average. You want to be as far away from average as possible, especially if you care about preventing disease.
Yeah, I completely agree. You've got to go against it. I mean, I'm sure it's the same for you, but when I was growing up at school, there was like one fat kid. There was like one fat kid in the school, yeah, or in the class. Like, not now, it's the one skinny kid. It's like it's completely flipped. And like you say, you don't want to be part of the majority now. You want to be in the minority because, as you said, that means you're doing things right because we're so unhealthy.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. No, I was just going to say on the genetics thing you mentioned as well, because, you know, when it comes to illness and disease, and people try and blame a lot of them on genetics, but like you said, it takes thousands of years for our genetics to change. And the rates that these illnesses are increasing, sure, you know, it's not genetics, it's being caused. You said, it's everything, isn't it? We're so far away from how humans are meant to live, with our diet, with our lifestyle, with our sleep, with our sunlight, everything. And like you said, all them things, it's just getting worse and worse. So we got to fight back against it.
Yeah. And to me, it's like a car, right? You know, if you're the type of person, I'm sure, you know, Ryan, that you're not the type of person, but there are some people who drive cars and they don't ever change the engine oil. They don't ever rotate their tires. They don't ever balance their tires. They don't ever do any of this standard maintenance that you should do with a car. And then, you know, 50,000, 60,000, 70,000 miles later, or maybe even less, they get a check engine light, or they have some type of calamitous event on the road, right? And if you think about it, whether it's their check engine light or it's the calamitous event, those are both indicators that something is wrong. Those are both very obvious and overt signs that something is wrong. So in my opinion, that's the same way we should be looking at disease in society, because you just made a great point. The recent rise in dysfunction and disease in society, it cannot be explained by something that has ostensibly, you know, over the duration of human existence, that has ostensibly not truly moved that much, which is our genetics. So, you know, when somebody wants to blame that, that doesn't make any sense. And in my mind, instead, the better solution is wondering, okay, well, you know, we have this recent rise in so many diseases and so much dysfunction. Maybe we need to stop ignoring the check engine light. Maybe we need to, you know, stop ignoring our car breaking down and figure out why, what is wrong with it? How do we fix it and get back on the road? And that is essentially not happening, at least in my opinion, right? You have so many other doctors, medical doctors, who are over-medicating, over-prescribing, you know, looking for procedures to bill more highly for. You know, nobody's necessarily focusing on the foundations of good health that I think is part and parcel of everybody in society.
Yeah, I agree. I think as well, with most people, they see the check engine light come on and maybe they feel the tires getting bumpy, but they just ignore it. You know, the signs are normally there, aren't they? But people ignore them.
Right.
And then, you know, that they go to the doctors and just, instead of looking at their health, they just go and get a pill to cover it up, which is like just buying an air freshener for your car or something and just being like, yeah, that'll sort it.
Right.
And it doesn't. So, I mean, as a doctor, obviously, how do you deal with, when patients come to you, are you freely able to give them advice on, you know, you need to sort out your life rather than me prescribing these drugs? Or, you know, are your hands a little bit tied within your job?
Did you just ask me that, Ryan?
Or is that something you can't discuss?
No. That's something I can discuss. Okay. It's just like, that's another question that I've never been asked before. Okay. Literally, I've done like over 30 podcasts, never been asked. So let's talk about it. I don't know how things are in the UK. But here in the US, we have an epidemic, in my opinion, of primary care doctors. That's the only type of doctor whose perspective I can speak from, right? I'm not a surgeon. I'm not a radiologist. I'm not a pathologist. I'm a primary care doctor. And most primary care doctors in this country are experiencing what I would call a deluge of patients, to the extent where they have over 3,000, 2,000 or 3,000 patients on their patient panel. And over the course of one day, if you just go to a primary care medical doctor's office and just observe, they are seeing between 20 and 30 patients. Okay, so now you need to ask yourself, okay, well, you know, 8-hour work day, and this doctor still needs to, whether they dictate or they you know, they chart, they write up their notes, they still need to spend time outside of that 8 hours articulating the events that transpire between them and their patients and their recommendations. But if we only look at 8 hours that they're seeing patients, if you are seeing between 20 and 30 patients a day, at most you have 10 to 15 minutes with each patient on average, right? So, and this was my experience that, to be honest, Ryan, absolutely shocked me coming out of medical school. I wouldn't even say coming out of residency, because I started to have my eyes opened to the reality of this during residency. Because obviously during residency, now you're in an office, you're seeing a whole bunch of patients. And I remember in residency, my program director was like, Nick, you got to move faster. You got to see these patients faster. And the reason why he was saying that is because I was that guy. Somebody comes in with stage one hypertension, right? So that is, in my opinion, stage one high hypertension, high blood pressure, that is a very redeemable place. So most doctors will look at somebody with the first stage of hypertension and they'll say, hey, we need to put you on medications immediately. What I would prefer to do, and this is me as far back as residency and even me now, is I would prefer to say, okay, let's look at this. You currently are at a degree of high blood pressure where, at least in my opinion, looking at the rest of your risk factors and looking at the aggregated picture, you are not in a place where there is a risk for sudden cardiac death. You're not just going to die tomorrow because of your elevated high blood pressure. So let's back up. Let's have an extended conversation, looking at every element of your life, thinking and focusing on the elements of your life that are most likely to be at least a contributor to this high blood pressure. And then let's change those things. Let's make the appropriate lifestyle changes. Here's the problem with that, Ryan. Time. That fundamentally takes time. That takes more time than a 5-10 minute conversation, right? Because you're going into the depths of somebody's lifestyle, somebody's choices in their life. And you know what's a lot faster than that? Pulling out my prescription pad from my white coat and writing a, you know, starting dosage for lisinopril or hydrochlorothiazide or clothalidone or any other blood pressure medication that I could just write you a pill for here, and then go to your pharmacy, go get it filled. So on one hand, writing a medication or writing for a medication is literally a 1 minute thing. Talk to the patient really quickly about potential risks, side effects, which in my mind is a, I would refuse somebody putting me on medication personally, because especially, you know, they're talking to me about side effects and risks. Why am I going to accept that? Or you could talk to me about my sleep and my nutrition and my movement patterns and my stress management and my mindset and my choices that are a direct result of my mindset, you know, and all of these things. If you talk to me about these things and I make the necessary changes, zero side effects. We're not talking about angioedema that you can sometimes have with lisinopril. We're not talking about any of the other, you know, myriad side effects that you could have with any other medication. So to answer your question, yes, this is a problem I personally experienced since residency, where if you're a certain type of doctor, which unfortunately for the system, I am, fortunately for me, I am. But if you're a certain type of doctor, unfortunately for the system, you are basically working against the system. You're not seeing patients in a way that's in accordance with what they want, which means you take too long to see patients, which means, you know, you're not putting money back in big pharma's pockets because patients aren't going to their pharmacy to fill prescriptions that you have written for. So yeah, it's a little bit of a, like I said, I don't know how it is there in the UK, but I know in the US, it's a little bit of a contentious issue to be a medical doctor who does not necessarily think like all other medical doctors, and you know, thus is life. And in my opinion, I'm not going to change my beliefs, my mindset, my ideology to fit into a system that, in my opinion, could be much better than it currently is.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, UK is pretty similar to the US in that you're going to get probably 10 minutes with a doctor at the most. Our healthcare is not private, so it's slightly run different, but it pretty much is. And it will be completely soon. But yeah, it's pretty similar, really. I suppose social media is, that's one of the wonders of social media, and one of the benefits is that, you know, you haven't got time in your appointments to be giving out the advice, but you can use social media as a platform to try and get some education out there, which is what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. But you have to keep in mind, even with that, Ryan, that and I tell people this all the time, social media is almost like it's almost like bait, is what I would say, because you know, we all know that I can't put, like, even so far we've been talking what, almost 40 minutes, we can't just put this out there on Instagram. Even if we could somehow put this on Instagram, nobody would watch the entire 40 minutes because people have no focus these days, right? No. So, you know, with that said, I think that social media is a bait insofar as it's being able to intrigue people and develop a level of curiosity that maybe then somebody will start to follow you because they want to, every time that you say you're, you know, 30 second to 60 second, you know, piece of content, they want to know, they want to learn more. And I have noticed that people genuinely want to learn more. People genuinely do not want to have to get on medications for the rest of their life. I don't think anybody wants that. The problem is, desire without change of decision is fantasy. It's just you might as well be fantasizing about random things, right? You need to have that desire, but then also be willing to change. So, yeah, you know, I utilize my social media to definitely educate people on things as it pertains to their health that they may not have been aware of prior. But, you know, I find that the people who truly have the most change are the people who notice what I post on social media and then reach out to me and try to take advantage of, you know, whatever I'm talking about in the Instagram reel or in the social media piece, because I like to give away a lot of free guides and a lot of content. And my most recent thing that I'm giving away, because I think that in reality it is foundational, and I know you agree with me, Ryan, it's nutrition and understanding everything about nutrition on a very granular level, at a level deeper than most people. As we talked about, you don't want to be the average, right? So on a level deeper than the average person understands it. So I basically put together a nutrition course, and I'll give you the link to that so that your viewers can check it out on my website. But, you know, ultimately, I think, you know, like I said, the people who benefit the most from social media are the people who realize that social media is just a nugget. It's just a glimpse, right? You have to dive deeper. You have to find people who align with your beliefs, align with your mindset, align with your ideology on social media, and then dig deeper, right? Instead of going broad, you want to go deep.
Yeah, I agree. Everyone's got to do a little bit of self-exploration and be open to questioning things, because I think one of the hardest things when people start is that you've essentially got to throw out everything that you think you know or that you've been taught so far. Yes. And start over. And I think that's quite hard, isn't it? Because you basically just got to accept that you were wrong about a lot of things and start over. And I think a lot of people struggle with that. I think once you get past that, then you're open to everything.
That's interesting, right? Because I was just talking with a member of my community on that yesterday. We have today's Thursday, and on Wednesdays, members of my very low cost community, we have what's called Q&A sessions. And he was bringing up the fact that literally what you're referring to now, and essentially we discuss how ego is unfortunately something that primarily holds people back in life in so many different aspects. And don't get me wrong, I'm not over here arguing that people should have no ego, because if you have no ego, if you have no pride, you take no passion, no, you have no desire to excel. You have no desire to show excellence through your work. So I do think that there is a degree of ego that is absolutely necessary. But I think that once the ego is too high, and what I define as an ego that's too high is being unable to reflect and consider that, maybe what you know isn't correct. Maybe, maybe you should consider somebody else's strategy, somebody else's approach, somebody else's viewpoint. And, you know, ultimately, I think that, you know, the people who are really representative of having too high of an ego are the people who won't even let you push back. If somebody, in my opinion, if somebody's really confident about their beliefs, they're going to let you push back on it. They're going to let you test their beliefs because they have so much conviction that they can articulate a response that will shut you down, that will absolutely show you that, nope, you're wrong and they're correct. But there are absolutely some people who, because their ego is so high, they won't even entertain your you know, attempted repudiation. They're just going to wholly and entirely shut it down and not even hear you out, not even listen to you. And those people, in my opinion, are the people who truly, you know, they're not able to understand, hey, I don't know as much about nutrition as I thought I did. Oh, you know, maybe my choices day to day are why I have this belly and why I have this metabolic disease. And oh, maybe it isn't just genetics. Maybe it's more than my family history. Maybe I should educate myself a little more. Nope. Sometimes these people are just head down. They just want to believe whatever they want to believe. More often than not, I'm sure you know, it's all about victim mentality. People love to believe that they are the victims, and the universe has conspired against me. My family history and my family genetics have conspired against me. And listen, I personally don't agree with that stuff. But it's interesting how I absolutely have some patients, some clients, some members of my community who they think that way, but their egos are low enough that they're willing to let me come in and just have a straightforward, honest, one-on-one conversation. And usually when I can have a one-on-one direct conversation with somebody about that, I don't even necessarily assert my beliefs. I question, if you question somebody deeply enough on their beliefs, you'll get them to realize, okay, this doesn't make sense, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing, because I think, like you said, a lot of them get so defensive because they don't actually have the argument to back it up. I think a lot of people, a lot of us, and we have to constantly look at ourselves and question this. A lot of us believe things that we've been told, but we don't even know why. We've just heard them. Yeah. Or someone said that, and we believe it. And I think that's why they get so defensive, because they know there's actually no argument. So like you said, if someone's a little bit receptive, it's actually quite easy to get them to come around to it, because a lot of it doesn't make sense. You know, I've got you know, clients saying to me that their doctor told them diet has nothing to do with Crohn's. Or people saying that carbs have nothing to do with diabetes. And it's like, well, if you just use a bit of common sense, we can start to see that there's some cracks in that.
Sure. Yeah. This is the type of stuff that just truly annoys me. Because listen, how do I say this? Here in the US, too many people put ultimate stock and ultimate confidence in what their doctor tells them. And okay, as a doctor, you might sit back and be like, oh, you know, that's a good thing. Like, you know, my patients never, you know, my patients always believe me. They never doubt what I'm saying. Personally, I think that's a bad thing. I actually have enjoyed my patients who push back on me, because then I sit back, I'm like, this is great. We can get into the details of the human body. Like, let's have a conversation. So, you know, I think personally, the most amount of respect you can have for your doctor is to not only listen to him or her whenever they say anything, but be inquisitive enough and curious enough to ask good questions. Because if you're asking the right questions, you will leave that interaction with your doctor with a level of understanding on whatever that subject matter was. You will leave with a level of understanding that far supersedes the average. So ultimately, just listening to what your doctor tells you blindly, please don't do that. Yes, I am a medical doctor telling you, do not listen to your doctor blindly. You need to be able to think and ask the right questions and get the right answers. And here's a warning. If you ask the right questions and they are not able to give you an answer that satisfies your curiosity, they're not able to give you an answer that puts you at ease as it pertains to their recommended treatment, then don't do it. How many times do we have doctors who are just, you know, saying, hey, you should, hey, you have high cholesterol, we should put you on a statin medication. But then you ask them, okay, why? What are the options? What are the alternatives? And they're not able to sit there in front of you, their patient, and articulate why you should be on that medication, articulate the latest research, articulate the positives and the negatives, the advantages and disadvantages of getting on the medication. All they're able to tell you is, hey, you should be on this medication. Tell me, what's the difference between that person who isn't able to articulate and defend their basis of thought and somebody who's a shill and somebody who's simply paid off by big pharma in one way or another to prescribe that? What's the difference? I mean, both of them are not able to defend their position, and both of them, you sit back as a patient and you question their motives. So personally, yeah, I think that's one of my biggest pet peeves, even as a doctor. I think that it's important for you to be able to ask the right questions as a patient. Myself in 2020, I was the heaviest I had ever been. I went through a couple months of just kind of, you know, difficulty and not necessarily staying on my P's and Q's. And so I went into my doctor at the heaviest I've ever been. And because I do have some degree, I have metabolic dysfunction in my family, right? Diabetes, high blood pressure. So for those of you who say, okay, well, you know, I can't control my family history, I can't control my genetics, I'm giving you a real world example, me. I have high blood pressure in my family history, I have diabetes. And when I went into my doctor's office in early 2020, that metabolic dysfunction manifested itself in high blood pressure. So I had stage one hypertension. My doctor at that point tried to put me on lisinopril. She tried to say, okay, she, I don't want to say her name, just to, but anyway, she tried to put me on lisinopril. And I told her, I looked at that and I just kind of, you know, sat back, looked at the chessboard and asked myself, am I truly at a place where I am okay with being put on a lifelong, on a medication regimen for the rest of my life to control high blood pressure, when I could instead sit back, evaluate all of my actions? Because that's the thing with high blood pressure. It's a, like most diseases that are, come from metabolic dysfunction, high blood pressure is a multifactorial problem. So I sat back, I looked at all my lifestyle. I made the relevant changes over the next 3 to 4 to 5 months. The next time I came back into her, I was, I think, 20 pounds down. My blood pressure was completely normal. There were no other issues. So I am not going to sit here. I think another difference that a lot of doctors will say is, okay, well, fix your weight and that will fix this issue. I don't actually believe that. I think that weight and obesity isn't the problem. It is a byproduct of the problem. So the true problem, at least in my opinion, is metabolic dysfunction. So metabolic dysfunction is essentially the cells of your body being unable to produce, utilize, and store energy in an efficient manner, such that you oxidize and you burn the right fuel at the right time. And that has prolific effects all over the body, because if you think about it, our body has trillions of cells, and those, every single cell in your body needs to be able to produce, utilize and store energy in some manner. And so all that really is needed for dysfunction to arise is for that process to be impeded in one way or another. And that's exactly, so this is why, in my opinion, obesity is simply a symptom. It's not the cause. It's a huge symptom, but, you know that you're doing things right when, you know, like what happened with me, when you come back into your doctor's office 5 months later and, you know, not only has your blood pressure gone away, but you're much lighter, you don't weigh as much, you have much more energy, you just have a lot more vitality. That's a sign that metabolic function is improving and things are going in the right direction. There is a quote that I was told in medical school that I don't know if you've heard of before, Ryan, but I'm about to say it. And I think it's extremely powerful. And I think it's something everybody needs to take away from this conversation. And that quote is as follows: genetics load the gun, but your lifestyle pulls the trigger. So if you have disease, whether it's type 2 diabetes, hypertension, high blood pressure, fatty liver disease, even cancer many forms of cancer, rather, are a byproduct of metabolic dysfunction. You may have a genetic predisposition. Absolutely. I'm not contending that. I'm not arguing against that. As I stated earlier, I have a genetic predisposition for diabetes. I have a genetic predisposition for high blood pressure. But in as much as that may be the case, your genetics only load the gun. They do not pull the trigger. You need a lifestyle that is, unfortunately, facilitating of disease for disease oftentimes to manifest itself.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's down to the environment of your body, isn't it, where the disease manifests itself. If you've got, you know, even if you have that genetic, you're more likely genetically to have that illness or that disease. If your body is a pure, healthy environment, then that disease is not going to be able to manifest itself. But when we've got this terribly unhealthy environment, anything can grow in there. You know, all of these things, these conditions can come and they can manifest and they can grow and they can take over because our environment's unhealthy. And that's why we need to look after environment. I think I saw a podcast clip of you the other day and you said something which I really, really loved, which was you were talking about the person that cares about your health the most is you. It has to be you. It won't be anyone else, your doctor, your mother, your father, everything. And I love that because that is true. And I think so many people have lost that and they think, well, the doctor will take care of me. Someone else take care.
No.
You've got to care about your own health. You've got to be the person doing it.
Yeah. And that's not to say, you know, if we want to dig into that statement a little more, that's not to say that the doctor won't take care of you. Mm. No, the doctor will. In the same manner, you know, at your age and at my age, our mothers, Ryan, will take care of us. They'll if you're sick and you go home, your mom will make you chicken noodle soup, or she'll take care of you and she'll baby you. But at the end of the day, nobody should care more about you and your health and your continued survival on planet Earth. Nobody should care more than you, right? This isn't an on-off. This isn't a binary, you know, thing. This is a spectrum. And if we look at it as a spectrum, right, maybe your mom, maybe, you know, this is not caring. This is caring. So your mom is over here. But the person who should be over here and caring as much as possible is you. And, you know, when people don't care anymore and they're not making the right decisions, or they want their doctor, or they want, you know, anybody else to care more about them than they care for themselves, what they're actually doing is putting that other person in a place where, I mean, it's drudgery. It's not even, you know, you can't, I have absolutely been in this situation many times, so I can speak on it, where I see a patient or a client and they are not making the right decisions. They're making every bad decision, from chronic drinking to smoking to eating processed foods to not moving. They're making every bad decision, but then they want me to come over here and, you know, lecture them or you know, sit there and plead with them to stop doing what they're doing. And that can't happen. That literally, you can't have even your doctor. You cannot be resisting change so much so that you want other people to work harder for you than you are willing to work for yourself. That makes no sense. That makes no sense. And if I ever had a patient like that, I would try one or two interactions with them, one or two or three. But then, you know, if I notice that just keeps going on, I mean, listen, I'm not a robot. No doctor that you're talking to is a robot, or they're not artificial intelligence or embodied artificial intelligence. They are human beings who, you know, you can absolutely drain them, right? And I think that you shouldn't try to drain anybody else. So yeah, I think that's huge.
Yeah, definitely. I think you spoke about it early on in this discussion about personal responsibility, isn't it? We've all got to take responsibility for ourselves. And I think there's a lot of people that have a lot of self-loathing, and they don't love themselves enough. They don't think they deserve to be healthy. And we need to start by changing that. Change your mindset. Start to care for yourself. And right. I find that if you start to care about yourself more and you love yourself more, making healthy choices becomes easy because you want to look after yourself. So I think if you can change the mindset, it comes from there.
Absolutely. Nope. Listen, Ryan, I've fundamentally said to so many people, I think ultimately the foundation of good health comes from mindset, right? Because you and I both know that any venture in life, you're not going to be successful at anything in life if you're not consistent. And that consistency is a byproduct of your thoughts. And your thoughts are a byproduct of your mindset. So fundamentally, if your mindset, the fundamental thing is screwed up, your approach is screwed up, nothing upstream will be positively affected. Everything will be negatively affected. So no, I entirely agree with you. I think that it's something that, you know, people need to approach it, or many people need to approach in a different manner.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, Nick, I know you've got to go. We're running out of time. I could happily chat to you for ages. We'll have to get you back another time to chat some more. But listen, before you go, you said you've got some free guides, you've got a website, you've got a community. So just let people know where they can find you, give a little shout out before you go.
Absolutely. So you and I, Ryan, we know each other. You know, we follow each other on Instagram. So I think that's a place anybody could find me. My username is representative of aspiring to become the best version of yourself every single day. So as a doctor, right, I aspire to become the fittest doctor that I can personally be, which is why my Instagram username is The Fittest Doc, all one word, obviously. I'm also on Instagram. I'm sorry. I'm also on Facebook and TikTok and YouTube. Though, to be honest, the platform where I am most prolific is Instagram. Otherwise, I do have a website. The website, actually, and on the website, you can get the free nutrition video course. It's an 8-module video course that I put together just to help educate whoever needs it, whoever wants it, right? It isn't even who needs it. It's the people who want to get the education. So you can get that at www.thefittestyou.org. So instead of the fittest doc, thefittestyou.org. There is a button somewhere there. I believe it's a green button that says get your nutrition masterclass here. You can use that to sign up. And I'm definitely enthused and excited to hear what people think about it and you know whether or not you like it.
Yeah, awesome. That is brilliant. I encourage people to go and check it all out. I will share your links in the show notes so people can easily find you and follow you. Awesome. And thank you so much for giving us your time.
Awesome. Yeah. Hey, and as you mentioned, I love this conversation with you. I apologize that I have to go right now, but let's definitely set this up in the future. Well, I'd love to talk more, and you're a blessing to talk to. So let's do it.
Yeah, definitely. We'd love that. We'll get you back. Right. And thanks again for your time. Thanks everyone else for listening. We will see you again next week. Until then, let's get optimal together.